More Ukrainian civilians killed as Russian strikes continue to hit residential targets.
The worst attack happened in the Dnipropetrovsk region, particularly in the city of Kryvyi Rih, which is a home city of President Zelensky. Again, it was drone attack. 6 drones were targeting the city and only one was shut down.
Plus, experts say Russia is using water as a weapon of war.
Pipelines have been attacked. Water treatment plants have been attacked, depriving many civilian centers of access to safe water and sanitation.
And later in the program, a pediatric trauma physician talks about the challenges of treating the child victims of bomb blasts. Today is Friday, March 24th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Lori London in Washington. Ukrainian officials say Russian long-range strikes have again killed and wounded civilians in several parts of the country. The attacks come as Moscow warned Friday that the Kremlin's forces are prepared for an expected Ukrainian counteroffensive in the coming weeks. I got an update from Anna Chernikova, reporting for VOA from Kyiv.
It was another late-night air alarm and almost across the whole country, but mostly central, north, and east part of the country. And it was quite a high risk of the drone attacks on Kyiv and Kyiv region, but at the end, nothing was reported. However, the area in the north suffered quite a lot due to this night attack. So here we're talking about Sumy region. Sumy is area which is bordering Russia at the north. This area also suffered quite badly during Russian occupation at the beginning of this full-scale invasion. So what we know for the moment that there are quite a lot of damages, particularly drone attacks. And for the moment, the operation of cleaning up is ongoing. According to the local officials, what was confirmed that 2 people were killed during this attack and 9 people were wounded. Also, over the night, it was quite a bad attack in the Donetsk region in the city of Konstantinivka, which is close to the frontline area. For the moment, again, we know that 3 people were killed during this attack. And unfortunately, one of the missiles hit at the so-called point of invincibility, which is a point where people can come to charge their phones, to get some warm drinks. So basically, such points were created across the country when outages began, and also especially in the pre-front areas. But the worst attack happened in the Dnipropetrovsk region, particularly in the city of Kryvyi Rih, which is a home city of President Zelensky. And what we know for the moment, so this is industrial city, so there are a lot of industrial facilities located there. And we know that it was drone attack. 6 drones were targeting the city and only one was shut down. So another 5 actually hit different areas of the city. There are quite a lot of damages, but there is no information about either victims or wounded.
And we're also hearing that Ukraine has repatriated wounded Russian soldiers, not something that has been reciprocated. What are you hearing about that?
Yes, today the coordination headquarters for the treatment of prisoners of war in Ukraine reported that actually Ukraine handed over to Russian side all seriously wounded Russian soldiers whose condition allowed the transportation. But this is not about the exchange. For the moment, it's about repatriation, and they are emphasizing that Russian side is still holding captive Ukrainian citizens whom it should return by this repatriation procedure according to the international humanitarian law. But again, we will see. Maybe this would change, and maybe Russian side would also follow this. But for the moment, we don't have any information on that and any confirmations. We only know that Ukraine handed over all seriously wounded Russian soldiers under this procedure.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. We hear daily reports on the devastating impact of Russia's full-scale assault on Ukraine, including on infrastructure and the electrical grids. As some 10,000 people meet this week to attend the UN Water Conference in New York, a just-released report details the devastating impact that Russian attacks on Ukraine's water supply are having on every aspect of life. I talked about it with Peter Glick, co-founder and senior fellow with the Pacific Institute, who co-authored the report.
Tell us a little bit about how the war has impacted water in this country.
Well, needless to say, the war has affected every aspect of life in Ukraine. And we've heard a lot about attacks on civilian infrastructure, on the cities, on energy infrastructure. But we've also seen a dramatic increase in attacks on other aspects of civilian life, in particular water resources, water systems, energy systems that provide energy for water systems that provide safe water and sanitation for civilian populations. We've seen attacks on the dams that provide energy or provide water for irrigation throughout the country. And we've seen water used as a weapon as well to flood areas downstream or deprive areas of water resources. So unfortunately, you know, one of the things we do is we maintain a database of water conflicts around the world. And unfortunately, the war in Ukraine has added a whole new set of entries for that database.
This study was actually conducted toward the beginning of the war, when this war started, in the early days. But the chart reports dozens of ways the war has impacted water throughout the country. What has that meant since the study?
Yeah, so that's right. This study, which has just been published, only looked at the first 3 months of the war, from February through, I guess, April or May of last year. And in just that short period, we documented over 50 examples where water has been a casualty of the conflicts, where water systems have been attacked, where dams and infrastructure have been attacked, where water has been contaminated by ammunition, by some of the consequences of the war itself. And we know that since that set of data were collected, there have been many, many more attacks. I mean, just recently, for example, the major dam, Kakhovka Dam, in the southern part, has been a focus of attacks. The dam itself has been attacked. The reservoir behind the dam has been drained by the Russians. That has caused serious problems for both water supply and, for example, for the nuclear plant at Zaporizhia, which is dependent on the water in that reservoir for cooling. There have just been a continuing number of attacks that, again, we've started to document. We haven't published yet. But again, it's a terrible example, unfortunately, of the way wars that aren't water wars. This is obviously not a water war, but it's a war in which water and water systems have been a victim.
I know you mentioned the drainage of the reservoir. What other ways has water been attacked?
The dam itself has been attacked. Several of the floodgates that control the water flows were destroyed about 2 or 3 months ago. Then the Russians opened other floodgates that drain the reservoir. That's just one example. But pipelines have been attacked. Water treatment plants have been attacked, depriving many civilian centers of access to safe water and sanitation. The United Nations estimates that 6 or 7 million people in the Ukraine now don't have access to reliable, safe water and sanitation because of the destruction of some of the civilian water treatment infrastructure in the cities. I would note those are violations of international law. The Geneva Conventions are very explicit that civilian water infrastructure is not to be attacked during conflicts. But unfortunately, those laws have not been respected.
And the consequences for availability and quality of fresh water resources for civilians is pretty much critical to life.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the consequences of failure to have access to safe water and sanitation is, you know, not just economic, but health. You know, we worry about water-related diseases, populations that don't have access to safe water or where sanitation is not adequately treated. You know, we saw this several years ago in Yemen and the conflict there, where water infrastructure was also attacked during that war. And there were severe outbreaks of cholera and dysentery as a result of the loss of safe water and sanitation. Now, I know the UN agencies and other agencies, the government of the Ukraine, are trying very hard to prevent that from occurring here. But there are still very large populations at risk from this failure to have access to, you know, what most of us fortunately get to take for granted, that is safe water and sanitation.
What are the consequences for the environment and for agriculture in Ukraine, which obviously leads to probably economic issues?
Yes, that's another important point. The reliability of water supply for agriculture has been threatened with the irrigation systems that have been destroyed or canals that have been dried up. We've seen contamination of water systems and rivers in part because of new sewage flows that are no longer treated, but also the weapons of war that have contaminated and are contaminating some of these river systems. You know, know, we've seen, again, in this report, we document examples where military hardware and ammunition weapons have been lost in rivers and are contaminating rivers themselves. You know, it's not an understatement simply to say that war is a terrible thing in general, but it's a terrible thing for water and water systems and the civilians that depend on water systems. It's going to be a long time, even if this war can be brought to a close, for Ukrainian agriculture to recover. They're going to have to repair agricultural systems. They're going to have to demine agricultural lands, and the water systems will have to be rebuilt as well. That's going to take a long time, and I think it's going to have a long-lasting impact on global food production.
Peter Glick, co-founder and senior fellow with the Pacific Institute.
UN human rights monitors have documented dozens of summary killings of Ukrainian and Russian prisoners of war, as well as other possible war crimes such as the use of torture, human shields, and other abuses against POWs since Russia invaded its neighbor. This, according to a report released Friday. The first full look by the UN Human Rights Office's mission in Ukraine at the treatment of POWs was released along with an update of human rights violations overall from a six-month period that ran through January. The report was based on interviews with about 400 POWs, half Ukrainians who had been released, and the other half Russians held captive in Ukraine.
EU leaders endorsed a plan this week for sending Ukraine 1 million rounds of artillery ammunition within the next 12 months to help against Russia. The Associated Press correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The meeting's conclusion on Ukraine reads, "The European Council welcomes the agreement to deliver ground-to-ground and artillery ammunition to Ukraine and, if requested, missiles." Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky thanked leaders for the initiative during a video call. With Ukraine facing ammunition shortages after more than a year of fighting, Estonia's Prime Minister came up with the idea of setting up a joint purchasing plan similar to the one devised during the coronavirus pandemic to buy vaccines. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. The Ukrainian government says that nearly one-third of its territory is mined, and that when the war ends, demining could last a decade or more. Evgeny Mozlov has more on the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
In the years since the Russian invasion, parts of Ukraine have turned into giant minefields. And while Ukrainian authorities have been dealing with Russian anti-personnel mines since 2014, the level of mining in the latest offensive has reached alarming levels. Michael T. Ray with the U.S. State Department Office of Weapons Removal and Abatement described the scale of the mining.
Government of Ukraine estimates 174,000 square kilometers of its territory, that's nearly a third of the country, may be contaminated with explosive hazards.
The U.S. government has committed over $91 million to support demining efforts in formerly occupied Ukrainian territories. European countries are also sending money and specialized demining equipment.
Your personal protective equipment, your metal detectors, your trauma kits, the vehicles to carry teams around, and the ambulances. This is at the core of a successful demining program. We also do support mechanical demining operations. So these are the larger demining machines that are particularly well suited for demining farmland.
Several nonprofit organizations like the Halo Trust have been supporting Ukraine's demining efforts since the initial Russian incursion in 2014. But it's not just mines. It's also the massive amount of artillery being used by the Russians that is causing problems.
Their tactics on the offensive, when they're trying to conquer new areas like Bakhmut, to use massive amounts of artillery, has the same effect, because it leaves those unexploded shells and mortar shells and other things in the ground that has the same effect.
A lot of those mines and shells end up in Ukraine's valuable farmland. According to Ukraine's Ministry of Agriculture, as much as 30% of the country's farmland is either occupied by the Russians or unsafe due to mining. And that farmland, according to the European Commission, provides over 10% of the world's wheat, corn, and barley. For Evgeny Maslov in New York, NRI's VOA News.
A team of doctors specializing in pediatric trauma are training medical personnel in Ukraine who lack the specific skills required to care for children injured by explosive weapons. I spoke with pediatric emergency physician Dr. Paul Reevely, who's working with Save the Children to facilitate the program. As of February, there have been more than 1,500 child casualties in Ukraine. Since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And landmines, as we just heard, are a profoundly serious problem.
There's a huge need, and there will be an ongoing need for many years to come. What we know about the pattern of conflict now is when you've got civilian areas being shelled with explosive weapons or mined, etc., is that children are disproportionate victims of that kind of conflict. So they are more vulnerable to blast injury, get more multiply injured. They have a higher mortality in the same healthcare system as, say, a civilian adult. And they place a great burden, a resource burden on healthcare in terms of the number of procedures that they need and the lifelong care then that they will require to maintain some sort of function. So if you lose your legs as a child, you know, you will need lifelong surgical and prosthetic care to maintain you as a functional adult in society, as a financially functioning adult. The nature of it is that usually there's very little pediatric trauma of this type in many countries, although globally we know that, you know, 1 in 6 children are at risk of blast injury, and probably roughly 240 to 50 million live in high-intensity conflict zones like Ukraine. And that when you get suddenly much larger numbers of this conflict trauma in children, then, you know, they simply don't have the pediatric services to deal with that amount of trauma. And if you're in a specialist children's hospital, then you may have people who are used to dealing with trauma and surgical problems, and people who are used to deal with children. But the likelihood is that they are going to require immediate care from physicians, clinicians, and medics who don't have that experience. So there's a huge confidence and knowledge gap when it comes to treating children, in particular with these types of extreme injuries.
Tell us a little bit about this training initiative.
We've been doing webinars for Ukrainian clinicians, and we've had a series of them. I think we've done 6 or 7 now. We're hoping to do maybe 12 to 15. And we focus on different areas of pediatric trauma care, from immediate care, as in pre-hospital care, to resuscitation, to the first steps of damage control surgery, and then into the critical care and onward care of the child. We've been delivering every 2 weeks about an hour to an hour and a half webinar to clinicians who are able to dial in. And that gives us an opportunity to focus on the key areas of knowledge that they need to deal with children, and also an opportunity for them to ask us questions as relatively experienced pediatric trauma doctors about what they are delivering or any areas of knowledge that they wish to address. And the key thing is that we are delivering topics that they are asking us to deliver rather than just sort of telling them what they need to know. So we're trying to meet their knowledge gaps. What we'd really like to do is back this up with some face-to-face trauma surgical training, either in Ukraine or by bringing clinicians to the UK. And we're sort of working on how we can deliver that for them.
I would imagine that not only does it entail dealing with the actual life-threatening injuries, but it may also deal with a lot of plastic and reconstructive surgical procedures. Is that pretty accurate?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the steps of care, really, when you've been injured with a blast or high energy trauma, initially the surgery is just to save life and limb. So that's the damage control phase, where you do just what's necessary to keep the child alive and enable you to resuscitate them fully. And then following that, you've got the stages of definitive care. And in limb injuries in particular, then they go into a long phase of limb reconstruction, where you try to preserve as much limb function as possible. Joint kind of approach from orthopedics and plastic surgery, where they salvage what they can and reconstruct where they can. And then, of course, that then goes into the prosthetic and rehabilitation.
There's also, I'm sure, the emotional impact. Is there a different way of handling it with children and these types of injuries as far as the emotional trauma?
From my experience previously, what people have when they know they're going to be faced with children is a huge heightened anxiety about dealing with children. The consequences are much magnified. You know, naturally, as human beings, we don't want children to suffer. We don't like to see children be injured, and we certainly don't want children to die. And that brings a mental barrier sometimes to dealing with children. That a key part of my kind of approach to pediatric trauma or pediatric care is to enable people to use the knowledge and skills that they have to meet the child's needs, even though they feel that they don't have them. Often we talk people out of treating children by telling them they're so very different and it's so very difficult to deal with them, and there's so many ways you can go wrong. It doesn't empower them. But actually, a lot of clinicians have got some very good skills, which, if they apply apply sensibly to the child, they'll do a lot of good. But it certainly has a bigger impact on you as an individual. And my own experience of having children, when you deal with a child, it often kind of mentally links you to that feeling as a parent, the sort of emotional window, we used to call it. And you have to be very aware of the impact that has on you and your group, your unit, your facility. If there's a failure or if a child dies, then that can have an enormous impact on the capability of everyone around you. It's clearly a very tragic thing. And the leaders in those groups have to understand that, and they have to be prepared for that. And they have to have a way of kind of dealing with that emotional output from dealing with children. At the start, you alluded to the landmine problem, and this will go on for decades to come, that the legacy munitions of war will be injuring children after we've stopped fighting in those areas. And it's a hidden area of impact, really, that has lifelong social and economic consequences for those individuals, the families in that country.
Pediatric emergency physician Paul Reevely. An art exhibition in Warsaw, Poland, brings together the work of Ukrainian artists who aim to capture the brutality of Russian aggression. The exhibition is entitled Ukraine, Under a Different Sky. For VOA, Lizia Bakalets reports from Warsaw. Elizabeth Chernoff narrates.
These are the sights and sounds in Ukraine under a different sky, an exhibition here at the Ujazdowski Castle Center for Contemporary Art in Warsaw. Visitors listen to the sounds of war in a dark room with scenes of the frontline city Kharkiv displayed on the walls. For some, the exhibit can be overwhelming. Beta Lupinska-Reitel is the museum's deputy director.
It was a couple from Ukraine, which I saw. They were in this room, and they just break out and start crying.
The exhibition includes 200 works documenting the impact of Russia's war on their homeland by Ukrainian artists, including Olga Drozd. Every piece of art here tries to answer one question: how is this horror real in the 21st century? The exhibition demonstrates war not only generally, but through artists' personal experiences. When Russia started the war, Drozd began taking photographs of her kitchen window in Kyiv. The items on her windowsill changed, and over time, so did the weather, but the glass window has remained unbroken. This exhibit is entitled Thank You for Another Day.
I just walked in my kitchen, looked at these red curtains and thought, thank God, the windows are intact today. I'm alive. I live near the thermal power plant in Kyiv, so my house often shook from the explosions.
In the next room, a bed is pierced with broken glass. Black paint is splattered all around. Artist Yulia Zakharova says it reflects how scared she feels when explosions wake her up.
For me, it is an association with my own bed, in which I woke up when full-scale aggression began. I panicked and did not know what to do next. And you know, the bed is something so sacred. It is something where we rest, where we feel safe.
Museum officials say the displays are meant to evoke empathy so that visitors can feel what life is like in Ukraine as Russia continues its attacks.
When you come into the exhibition, you can actually feel it more, what's going on at the moment. Through art, you can explain the war in a different way. It's much more emotional. It gets into your heart. We don't want people to get used to the war. We want people to talk about that Ukraine needs to be armed and need support all the time.
The exhibition in Warsaw runs to mid-May. For Lesia Bakalets in Warsaw, Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm Lori London. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.